Okay, thanks everybody. More stuff off the head discussing. Parsha Shuma. I also want to try to discuss the Parsha of the Haftorah. And I also had a share that I was planning on giving the intro to Megillas Esther the first time. And I doubt I'll have time to cover everything, but you're more than welcome to reach out to me directly, and I'll be happy to send you a 22-minute share that I gave the other day on the first parak of Megillas Esther. So just briefly, obviously there's lots to talk about, Parsha Shuma, the Yichud Shuma.
Is that what it is?
Hold on a second. Okay, so we all know that in Parsha Shuma, Akash Baruch Hu requests Yichud Shuma. So why does it say that we should... why does it say Yichud you should take from each Shuma as opposed to you should give Shuma? Because I think one of the fundamental understanding of this pasuk is that everything that we have ultimately comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if we live life by saying, that through my own creativity and ingenuity was I able to create this wealth, then you'd really be missing the key ingredient, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention in your success. And so, and we can actually double the question by saying, what's the purpose of giving charity at all, right? Because Haggai had once said, Leah kesef, Leah azav, Amar Hashem, I have all the wealth, I have all the gold, all the silver. So why is it that, I need you guys to provide me with something? And the answer is that we have a societal obligation to one another to help each other during difficult and trying times. Some are more sensitive to this, I have profound akaras to certain people that are listening to this call, that are aware that at certain times in a person's career, they undergo certain challenges, and of course there are people that step up and help. But this obligation is really panoramic because we have this fundamental yisod, efes ki lo yedecha evyon. We have a responsibility that we should always be able to uplift other people. And so v'yichli truma really begs the question, how should we consider giving? What should be the thought process when we do the giving? Or what should be the gold standard of giving? And what could be a form of giving, but maybe not on the highest level? So we have Zahav, Kesef, and Nechoshet. And Zahav is an acronym for Zeh Hanosein Bari. This is somebody who gives when he's healthy. There's no reason to give other than the fact that someone asks for help, and the person just rolls up their sleeves and says, "Okay, how can I help you? What amount would be able to put you on your feet again?" And that usually comes from a parent, right? But let's say a person is never doesn't have parents, so leaning on a friend. So obviously that would be something that a friend would step up and try their best to do. Then you have the next level, which is kesef, which is kishiyesh sakana poseach. That when there's a time of uncertainty, then you open up your hands and you give, right? If you hear a report that doesn't come back to your liking and you want to obviate the outcome, right? We say tzedakah tafel mimadah, so we give charity. Kishiyesh sakana poseach. When there's a danger, we open up and give. And the copper standard, which is nechoshes, is nesinas cholesh amar tenu. The giving of a person who's not so well just says take it, because that person can't enjoy it the way that other people can. This person's not going to be flying down the Matterhorn in the Swiss Alps. This person's not going to be driving a McLaren. So the person says, you know what, you need it, go ahead and take it and enjoy it. So those are the three standards of giving. And that's how we approach Truma. There's a lot of different elements to giving, but the most important part is that it should be Yedivenu Libo. And the Kutzker brings down that whether it's a person is sacrificing a behema, Pasuk says Reach Nechoach Hashem. A person is sacrificing an Olas Oaf, which is a bird, then the Pasuk there says Reach Nechoach Hashem. It's a pleasant smell, pleasant offering to Hashem. If a person is only able, because of their financial condition, to offer a Karba Mincha, which we know is consistent or consists of flour and water, and base chemicals, base products, that Malo Kum So, right, can fit within three finger breadths of width. And so it's a very small offering, and it's commensurate to the person's financial ability and condition. Then that, too, is Re'ech Nechoch Hashem. So explains the Kutzker that there's a fundamental yisod. When a poor person is going to give charity, he's going to have tremendous kavana, because this is really something that comes from, food that he would otherwise consume for himself. And, a poor person is always wondering, like, when's the next meal going to come? How will it come? So maybe I need to set aside a little more. But the question that we have to ask ourselves, explains the Kutzker, does the rich person have the same level of kavana? And so the Kutzker says, he finalizes by saying that surely the poor person has much kavana. But now we have to be worried about the rich person, because the rich person can say, I gave an ox as a sacrifice, but I didn't have the right kavana. You know why? Because I could afford to give you many more oxen as sacrifices. So much of what we're learning even now in Maseches Pesachim, when it comes to the Karban Pesach, about the intent, about the sacrifice, about the intent, the cause of our actions, so much driven by thought. And the absence of thought, and the absence of kavana, the Karban itself could be void. So therefore, it's required of us that we think before we give, and that when we are giving, we are thinking about, channeling these monies and the sacrifice to the right cause. So that's the Kutzker, Rabbi. Always a timeless word from the Kutzker. The second or third part of the Dvar Torah tonight is really focused on Shaul HaMelech and the failed attempt to destroy Amalek, and also the correlation to the Megillah itself, because we're going to be reading that very soon. And that is that Esther says in the Megillah, Sumo alai v'al tochu v'al tishtu. You should fast. You shouldn't be eating. You shouldn't be drinking. We all know that the storyline of Purim actually took place on Pesach. But we move it back, because if we had to mix the two together, I think our wives would be very upset. How are we going to manage the two, chametz and non-chametz products? So therefore, Sumo alai v'al tochu v'al tishtu is really redundant. Because if you're fasting, then obviously you're not eating, you're not drinking. So why does it say that you shouldn't be eating, you shouldn't be drinking? You shouldn't be eating Sumo alai v'al tochlu. You shouldn't be tochlu the matzos. Al tishtu arba kosos. So, and when there's a void, says the Medrash Rabbah, when there's a void of the Jewish person eating the matzos and not consuming the dalak kosos, Kosh Baruch Hu wants to know, why is that so? And then that's what channeled this great intervention. Balayla hu nazashnafa melach, as we read in Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph, that the king's sleep was disturbed. Why was it disturbed? Because of the possible pending decree, if it were to be fulfilled, would have grave consequences on the continuity of the earth. Because as the pasuk says, "Lo brisi yom v'layla chukos shemayim v'aretz osamti," that the world is really sustained by Torah learning. And if there's no Torah learning, then the world would be in jeopardy. So when we look back at the origin, we can actually learn from a first grader who finished Shas several times every year, actually, Rabbi Ruderman Batzal, and I'm sorry, Rabbi Ritterman, who was actually a cousin of mine. And one of the things that he brought out was that Haman had three dice, and we all know that on every dice, it equals to seven, which is teva, which is the nature of the world, right? On the opposite of a three, you have a four. On the opposite of a five, you have a two. On the opposite of a one, you have a six, right? So he was waiting to get 133. What's 133? What's the significance of Agag, right? Haman was looking for, when he can channel his ancestor, Agag, right, which was discussed in the Haftorah of the Parsha of Truma, and what we read on Parsha Zachar. And what's the opposite of 166? The opposite of 1 is, I'm sorry, of 133. Agag is 133. What's the opposite of 133? So the opposite of a 1 is 6, and the opposite of 3 is 4. So 464 is David. And he was waiting for an opportunity where Agag would be above the house of David. And so he found that this would be the proper month of Adar. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu was Nifter in the month of Adar. But he also failed to recognize that Moshe Rabbeinu was also born in the month of Adar. And Adar is an auspicious month. And Chazal bring down that the Yom HaDin is actually Purim. It's not any other day, right? Because we have to be able to see the Yad Hashem and everything that we do. So it's really 6 months in. We're already 6 months in from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which means that we're only 6 months away from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur as well, right? And the year is moving pretty quickly. So there's a lot to be said about Purim, but there's even more to be said about the Haftorah itself, and that is that Shaul HaMelech believed that he was doing the right thing by having mercy on the king, known as Agag. And Shmuel HaNavi receives a nevuah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that night and says, wait, what do I hear in the wilderness? I hear sounds of cattle. I hear all these things emanating from the camp. Why is it that you even thought to consider that Shaul would be the appropriate king? It's not possible that we should be able to keep Shaul as king. But Shmuel HaNavi comes next day and slays Agag. Right? And he tells them, in the same way you had no mercy on women and children, so too we have no mercy upon you. And that's the end of the story. But it also sealed the fate for Shaul HaMelech, because we all know that Shaul had mercy on our enemy. And because he had that mercy, Agag was able to procreate, and from Agag came Haman. So if Shaul was able to have destroyed Agag, then perhaps we never would have had a need for a Purim, which Purim actually means a lottery. And the Medrash Rabbah discusses at length what the nature of the lottery consisted of. It was months, it was days of the week, and it was actually quite fascinating how Haman singled out Adar and the day of Adar the 14th day of Adar to single out his decree upon the Jewish people. But it's also fascinating to note that Shaul HaMelech, in a few chapters forward in Shmuel Beis, I believe, when he learns that David had taken refuge in the town of Nov, Doeg HaDomi, his chief military advisor, insults and says, well, these people are treasonous, and so they deserve capital punishment. And Shaul allowed the punishment to take place, and 80 Kahanim were slain. And so later on, when Parshas Emor in Medrash Rabbah brings down that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to see into the future through a prism, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals to him all of the Malachim from the different Shvatim, from Yisrael and from Malchus Beis David, and he sees that the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, is slain by the sword. And he says, how is it possible that Shaul HaMelech could fall by the sword? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response is, Emor el HaKohanim. Go speak to the priest. Speak to the Kohanim. What kind of answer is that? The answer is that we're talking about consistency of message, that a king has to be consistent. If you're going to be merciful upon your enemies, you have to be merciful upon your own brothers and sisters. If you're not going to be merciful, then it may make sense for you not to be merciful later on as well. And then at least you'll have some form of consistency. But a Jewish person has to operate with consistency, and that's the message that Shaul HaMelech failed to observe. And it's also the same message that is very uncomfortable when we see our enemies, especially during World War II, Nazis that were taken captive. They, like Hermann Göring, who in 1923 was one of the leaders of the Beer Hall Putsch, he was wounded. And then he was nursed back to health by a Jewish couple living in Munich. And yet, there was zero Hakaras HaTov, because during the time of 1938 in Kristallnacht on November 9th, he was the one who ordered that the Jewish people should repay and compensate the German government for all the glass that had been broken by the German populace. And then when he surrendered, he handed over his dagger to the captain, and the captain handed him a pack of cigarettes. I don't even know if he smoked. But the idea is that it's incredible or incredulous behavior to treat a known war criminal a monster, a beast, with this form of camaraderie, that because he is a senior level official, so therefore you have to treat him as such. Shlomo Melech made the same unfortunate mistake. It was a grievous one because he viewed Agag as a king, and he's also a king. So kings take care of other kings. And as far as the sacrifices that had yet to be offered, Shlomo Melech opined that maybe it was just, you know, a timing issue, because he planned on offering these oxen, the best of the cattle to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that would be actually the spoil. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu had clearly given the instruction that not only was the camp of Amalek to be destroyed, but everything about it as well. And since Saul showed mercy to his enemies, that's a message that we have to learn. We have to learn about the message of consistency. And that comes to Limud HaTorah, that comes to setting aside time for learning, whether it's Daf Yomi, whether it's your enjoyment, whether it's other things that we can engage and learn and grow together, whether it's Mantfila, whether it's Makom in the Beis HaKnesses, or some people feel more comfortable dabbing at home these days, that's okay too. Whatever it is, let's try our best to be consistent about it. And just maybe one thought or two about the Megillah. We already touched upon it just a moment ago. But, you know, in the very first parak, the Ben Ish Chai brings down that Mordechai and Haman were soldiers. And whereas Mordechai was able to amass great wealth and then to secure his wealth in the form of wealth preservation, Haman, you know, pilfered through his own monies and became destitute. And therefore, he leaned on Mordechai for a loan. And as a result, he sold himself into slavery. The irony about all this is that Mordechai saw in Haman an individual that he could trust in form of extending the loan, and the fact that, as we say in the Torah, Kol Masha Kone Eved Kone Rabo, that whatever the slave acquires, and so when Haman was able to acquire the fate of the Jewish people, it was really Mordechai, and that's why later on, when Ahasuerus handed over the house of Haman to Mordechai, Esther hands it over directly to, I'm sorry, Ahasuerus hands it over to Esther, Esther gives it over to Mordechai, because he in fact was the rightful owner. And then one final thought is that Haman is in the chatzar of the king, and imagine if he would have came a minute too early, then he would have heard the king saying, who is it that I never repaid, right? And then the conversation shifted to Mordechai, obviously. And what happens if he would have came a moment too late? Then it would have been, well, how am I supposed to rectify the wrong of not recognizing Mordechai's gallantry and his valor? So, you know, oh, we should go ahead and parade the individual through the city streets. You know, so then he would have also been at odds with that. He probably would never have approached. But the fact that he walked in at the very moment that he did, at that particular time, wasn't a special time for the Jewish people, right? Because he hadn't heard the discussion at hand, and he actually thought that he was the person who was going to be receiving all of this glory. So there's a good deal of irony about the people who tried to destroy the king, Bigthan and Zeresh. They were the ones who ended up being slain, including Haman. And then those who tried to support the king, those are the ones who end up vanquishing our enemies. And so we do have a Seuda on Purim. We do not have a Seuda on Hanukkah. And to close out the thought, because on Purim, we were able to not lose anybody in battle. And so therefore, we celebrate the fact that we were able to vanquish our enemies. However, on Hanukkah, even though we achieved great miracles through the lighting of the menorah, etc., we still lost tremendous amounts of Jewish lives during the course of that battle, both physically as well as spiritually. And so therefore, we don't celebrate, says the Maharik, on Hanukkah with a Seuda Hanukkah. We do have get-togethers, but it's not the same as a Seuda and a Simcha and the Simcha Sechaim that we commonly enjoy over the festive holiday of Purim. So I want to wish everyone a wonderful week, a wonderful Chag, and we should usher in a time, as we say, Adar is Ani Hashem Rofecha. There are many people that still need a Refuah Shleima. Let's have in mind. And also, Nisan is the time of miracles. Nisan Nigal, Nisan Asin Nigal, perhaps. or maybe it could be Tishrei as a result of Aras Chosam. And then we have, of course, Iyar. Iyar is Ani Hashem Rosacha, once again, circling back to where we began, where obviously those in need of a refuah should hopefully receive one speedily in our time, in our day. This is Mordechai Plotzker from Elizabeth, New Jersey, and wishing you the very best. And Bez Hashem, we should continue to learn together back on Sunday night. And all the my very best to each of you. Take care.